Devoncast from Radio X.
So welcome to another brand new Devoncast, your weekly roundup of all the big stories happening across our beautiful county, captured for posterity in podcast form. Now, seeing as it's just been the county show, we'll say your artisan Devoncast is lovingly handcrafted. Under the auspices of Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service, I'm Guy Henderson, and I'm joined once again today by my LDRS colleagues, Alison Stevenson and Bradley Gerrard. And we're all excited, aren't we? Because last night, as we're talking on Thursday here, a general election was called and it's going to happen on the 4th of July.
Oh, Independence Day. I love it.
We love an election, though, don't we? The podcast will continue to cover local politics all the way through the election campaign. We are bound by certain rules, which means that we will be fair and we'll be unbiased and everybody will get a fair crack of the whip. And you listeners need to hold us to account if we're not doing that. But I'm looking forward to it. How about you guys?
Yeah, definitely. I think we've got some really interesting seats in Devon. We've had a lot of new constituencies, and the patch of Devon that I cover, I think, is quite interesting. You've got some great contests. So you've got Exmouth and East Exeter, which is a new seat. There's no current sitting MP vying for that. So all the candidates are either local councillors or new to politics. Then Honiton and Sidmouth, another new seat. There's two MPs who are currently sitting MPs vying for that one. You've got the Conservative Simon Jupp, Liberal Democrat Richard Ford among the runners. Obviously, there are other candidates fighting for that seat too, but they'll be battling that new constituency. And then also new is Tiverton and Minehead, where Ian Liddell Granger, who's currently the Conservative member for Bridgewater and West Somerset, will try and remain an MP, but obviously in that new seat. And he's against a host of rival candidates. Perhaps the most well-known one is again a Lib Dem, Rachel Gilmore, who's a Mid-Devon district councillor at present.
It's going to be absolutely fascinating. South Devon, West Devon, North Devon, all the same. But I think East Devon, you've got the biggest shake-up of all of them, Brad.
I really think so, yeah. Just the map on that edge of the county has been completely redrawn, really. I think it's going to be a really interesting time for me and the county, seeing who emerges in those new seats.
We've got a new Torridge and Tavistock, it's being called now. It was Torridge and West Devon. And it's not that different. It doesn't have Buckland Monocorum in it and Burrator. That's going to South West Devon. But on the whole, it's quite similar. But we've got Geoffrey Cox, Conservative MP, obviously standing again for that one. But we've got some new faces in there. So that should be quite interesting as well. I think Plymouth's going to be quite interesting. I think Johnny Mercer and Luke Pollard obviously going for their roles again, but there's some strong competition there, so we shall see what happens.
Now, as luck would have it, our boss was literally passing Downing Street yesterday in a downpour at the crucial moment. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. And he managed to grab a chat with a couple of local MPs before Rishi Sunak's suit had even dried out after that soaking that he got out there. First of all, Paul Nero caught up with Exeter's Labour MP Sir Ben Bradshaw, who is, of course, standing down from Parliament this time around after serving the city since 1997.
It did come as a surprise, although as soon as I saw Sunak at Prime Minister's Questions, I thought there was something very different about his body language. He appeared rather more zen than usual, as if a huge weight had been lifted from his shoulders, having taken the decision. But I didn't read very much into that. But it's happening. I'd always thought they'd wait till the autumn in the hope that something turned up. Winter elections are more difficult for Labour because it's cold and dark. But I'm delighted that he's brought the election forward, because I'm looking forward to leaving.
that's sad in many ways. You've been doing this for 27 years, and I guess you deserve a retirement. Looking back on those years, what would you think your achievements have been?
Well, I've always tried my best to represent Exeter as a constituency MP and, help make Exeter the success story that it is today. From bringing the Met Office down, getting a new medical school, getting all our high schools rebuilt, transforming attainment in our schools and therefore the life chances of young people locally, Exeter College as well and university, are getting investment into the city and good new jobs. And at the same time, you know, it's been a huge privilege, as well as doing that, being able to serve as a government minister in the Tony Blair and Gordon Brown governments. And I shall be hopefully cheering on my Labour successors from my retirement in Sicily. And I just hope that they have the stamina and the grit to knuckle down if we win the election and really deliver for the British people and make the kind of change that 1997 to 2010 election made in our country, which was overwhelmingly for the positive.
And you have quite a big majority still. I know it went down at the last general election under the last management of the Labour Party. And the candidate for Labour is a long-standing friend of yours and somebody you know well. So tell us something about Steve.
As we speak, Steve is out campaigning in Exeter, out meeting the voters, and he'll make a great MP. He worked for me, so I've trained him very well. He'll do Exeter proud. He has an extraordinary backstory, brought up by a single mother, first of his family ever to go to university, and has really pulled himself up by his bootstraps. And he has a real personal knowledge and experience of how difficult it is for particularly working class families to break through that ceiling. So, and he's a very hard worker as well. So I think he'll be a fantastic successor in Exeter, should the Exeter voters have the wisdom to elect him.
And what next for you?
Well, I haven't quite worked out what I'm going to do immediately, because I wasn't expecting it to happen in the way it has. But I should be down in Exeter this weekend, and I'll be out knocking on doors and campaigning for Steve. And after that, I haven't really worked out what I'm going to. I mean, after the general election, our plan is to go to Sicily and lead the good life, making olive oil and watching the birds and the bees and the butterflies.
Your opposition might not think it, but I know from the experience we've had over the years that your constituents believe you're a very successful and committed constituency MP, so we'd like to wish you all the best for the future.
That is very kind of you. It's been a huge privilege, and my constituents have been extremely kind and generous to me, particularly since I announced I was leaving.
Paul Nero talking to Sir Ben Bradshaw there moments after the announcement of the July the 4th general election. He also tracked down, as you just mentioned, East Devon's Conservative MP Simon Jupp, whose constituency has all changed this time around. And it's fair to say that he's on the front foot already.
So, Simon, the starting gun has been fired. You will no longer be an MP from Friday and no longer ever be East Devon's MP, because there won't be an East Devon constituency. It's new. Sidmouth with Honiton? Honiton with Sidmouth? Which way round is it? And are things uncertain?
So the new constituency is called Honiton-Sidmouth. I'm the only candidate that's declared who actually lives in the new constituency, which is a disgrace, but it gives me the upper hand and other candidates who don't live there and obviously don't care about the area as much as I do, because I'm standing where I live. I'm very sad to be East Devon's last MP. It was a great title, but I'm fighting for the title of Honiton and Sidmouth MP, and I'm up for it.
It normally comes with a knighthood, I've seen, for the last... Are you fighting for that title?
I'm fighting for the Honiton and Sidmouth constituency, the area in which I live, the area in which I care about, and I've got a track record of delivery, right? I don't deliver just words in Parliament. I get stuff done, and that's what I'll continue to do if I'm elected.
But this is a little niggle at your competitor, Richard Ford, isn't it? He lives in his present constituency. It's not his fault that the boundaries are changing.
He had a choice, like I had a choice. So our constituencies were both abolished, and he had a choice and I had a choice. I decided to stand where I live, he didn't. That's up to him. My campaign will all be about my plan for the area in which I live and where I care about.
Were you surprised by the announcement coming today?
I think that it was a little bit of a surprise, but we're ready. We have spoken to thousands of voters over the last couple of months. I'm out every single week, knocking on doors, speaking to people, attending public events, and the feedback is good. I am buoyant.
You've got your leaflets ready. We'll receive soon at Beyond Them.
course the Prime Minister will be on it. The Prime Minister has made the difficult decisions that are necessary. Think about the pandemic, the furlough scheme, all he did to save businesses. The high streets of places like Honiton and Sidmouth would look very different if it wasn't for Rishi Sunak. I'm proud he's our Prime Minister. He's called the election. I will fight to win.
Paul Nero talking to Simon Jupp there. Yeah, general election time. Guys, what's the first general election you can remember? Not just from working point of view. I can actually go back to the Harold Wilson election of 1964, which is an awful long time ago. I don't remember much about it, but I remember there being an election happening when I was very, very young. So that must have been 64. So yeah. I'm claiming 1964 as my earliest general election memory.
Well, I mean, I remember Margaret Thatcher, and I just remember her being there forever. And I think my whole sort of childhood, it was Margaret Thatcher. I got really excited about politics when I covered the 1997 election. Yeah. When it was, you know, basically the Labour landslide. So they'd not been in for 18 years and you know, they got the most amount of seats they'd ever had, I think. And I remember when Michael Portillo lost his seat and it was just the drama of the whole thing. It was so exciting. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm quite into politics now. So I think that's where it started it off, really. But it's a really interesting time, and I think for us it's like the best job at the moment, isn't it? Because it's all happening in politics, so it's great.
I think that for me that 97 election is probably the most formative in my memory as well. The first one really that I probably remember, I was 13 at the time, and you know that I guess I remember how New Labour, as they started themselves, and really sort of grabbed hold of popular culture. And I just really remember that time of them grasping hold of pop stars and that kind of thing, and really making it sort of seem attractive and fun. And I guess, yeah, that obviously worked among the voting public because of their obvious win.
And that song that's coming out again, that D-Ream song, yeah, things can only get better. And that was in the background, wasn't it, when Rishi was talking about the election yesterday.
I did like the Guardian's headline this morning, which was "Things can only get wetter," because of the absolute downpour that happened.
Yeah. Yesterday. Well, I am hoping that Labour choose a new campaign song. I think dragging out that old one would be a bit much, really. If it's all about change, they've got to change the song.
There'll be plenty of suggestions, no doubt. And all the famous candidates as well. Down the years, there've been some quite interesting people who've ended up standing in local seats. I remember when Boris Johnson's dad stood at Newton Abbot a few elections ago. That was quite entertaining. And a fellow called Willie Hamilton stood in Totnes against Anthony Steen 40 years ago. And he was an absolute socialist firebrand that Labour parachuted into Totnes. And he didn't quite resonate with the people of Totnes, but it was entertaining. It was good fun following him around to meetings and on the stump and what have you. We will be having hustings meetings as well, by the way. Radio X will be hosting hustings meetings in conjunction with the Local Democracy Reporting Service, and we'll be keeping you up to date on where and when those are going to be happening.
And yeah, and besides national politics, it's been a week of pretty big political moments in Devon too. The County Council leader, John Hart, is officially stepping down after 15 years in the job. I met him recently, shortly after he announced he'd be handing over the reins of County Hall to fellow Cabinet member James McInnes. And we chatted about his career, including the achievements he's most proud of, and what had changed in the time since he first became a councillor back in 1989, when I was five. I'm putting together a long read article taking in our comprehensive chat, but I've cobbled together a small part of our interview for this week's podcast. So here's John Hart speaking to me early this month from his very austere and very normal office. I really like the environment he works in. It's amazing he's done it from there for so long. Here's a bit of my chat with John. John, obviously here speaking to you today, you're coming to the end of your very long tenure as leader of Devon County Council. Casting your mind back, what made you get into politics in the first place?
I suppose to a certain extent by default, because I was asked to drive local member of parliament around for part of the time of this general election in 1964. And from there I joined the Young Conservatives, I then married my wife, who was also a young Conservative. And then I suppose I grew into the senior Conservative side, got involved in the Torridge West Devon constituency. From there, we had Michael Heseltine. I worked closely with him for 8 years. And then when he moved on, we had Peter Mills. But the political machinery at the time for the Conservative Party was that we ran the best coffee mornings. We had the best wine and cheese parties. We had the best gatherings. And on that, people joined us. And then subsequently, they joined the Conservative Party.
So you think organizing people was a big part of your love of politics and getting people engaged in it, I guess, as well?
Getting people engaged, yes. But I also feel that politics is life in some shape or form. We have rules and regulations, they all come from something. But for me, it was very much a transition from the voluntary sector to become a councillor that was probably the bigger change. I suppose it kind of grew from being a lowly beginning early councillor, giving some responsibility by the then leader of the council, and being asked to sort out a lot of the issues that hadn't been dealt with when amalgamation had taken place in 1974, between Plymouth, Devon, Torbay and Exeter to become one new council.
Obviously, you've had a long political career, but is there one particular thing that you would say stands out as the thing you're most proud of achieving?
In the last 15 years, obviously, it's running the county council. But the biggest mark impression I made in this council undoubtedly was reorganising the Exeter education system. We did that from 2001 to 2005. I was asked, it was a rainbow alliance. All four political parties here had seats on the cabinet. I was asked by the leadership of the groups to run schools and also change Exeter's education system from a first, middle and high to a primary, secondary system. I negotiated with the parents, the teachers. I also negotiated with government and I went forward and asked for a minimum £57 million. From the minister. At that time, the members of parliament with me said, come off it, John, you'll be lucky if you get 37 million. I said, sorry, minister, ignore them. Look at the paperwork I'm producing. Tell me what you think I'm worth. 8 weeks later, she gave me £79 million, which gave us the opportunity to do a really dramatic change in the Exeter's education system. And before we'd finished, we had already increased the standard of Exeter's education by 10 points.
And is that the impact of those changes? Is that still felt, would you say, and visible today even?
That is still visible today. The new schools of 2005, 2007 are still well used today. 5 brand new secondary schools, 1 brand new primary school at Windstream. The other 26 schools were all changed to be able to accommodate the different age groups of children that were going through them. We've built new schools since then, including one that is very much eco-friendly, highly expensive. Exeter change dramatically affected 17% of the children being educated in Devon.
I mean, the media landscape in your political career has changed a lot, and I guess the political one has too. But I'm interested to hear from you the context of being a politician. Are things seemingly more controversial now, even if they're actually not? What's your view on kind of the level of angst or controversy that's generated now over potentially small things?
People want instant answers today. They want much more instant reaction, and they really want it solved if it's possible. It's come at a time when we have less money and less ability to be able to do it. But I do find that if you tell the people the truth, that you can't do it, and you explain why you can't do it, they do accept it. You're getting the problem, but it isn't your problem to solve. It is changing. It has changed, certainly post-COVID, but even pre-COVID, we were going from originally a fax machine to mobile telephones to now Teams meeting. Everything is faster, everything is jammed up. A lot of the time, we don't really finish something before we go to the next, and that is a mistake. I've always said, finish it first. That's what we've got to do. Do what you're doing, get it finished, then you can move on. Otherwise, you have too many unfinished bits hanging around, and people think that they're not getting the service they deserve.
So that was my chat with John Hart there. And as we're speaking actually later today, John will become the chairman of Devon County Council, and in a year's time, he will relinquish that Wembley seat that he holds, which, as I said earlier, he's held since 1989.
You're listening to Devoncast, which is available on the Radio X website and app, from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio, which is on DAB digital radio across most of the county.
There'll be much, much more on the general election in the coming weeks from Devoncast. In other business this week, we'll have the latest on the Brixham Cryptosporidium outbreak. It's easy for me to say. With the local MP who becomes a mere candidate again the minute Parliament is dissolved next week. I also have a huddle with a very important man, and I'll try to shed some light on the current chaos afflicting Torbay Council. It's been a very busy week, but first...
Well, one of the big issues in everyone's manifesto will be homelessness, which has been on the rise over the last decade. Homelessness charity Shelter recently honed in on Plymouth, revealing that just 331 social homes have been built since 2014, whilst the number of households in temporary accommodation has tripled. Social homes are rented properties that are around 30 to 50% cheaper than private rents. According to the National Office of Statistics, the average cost of a private rented property in Plymouth is now £873 a month, and 42% of private tenants are forced to rely on housing benefit to cover escalating housing costs. More than 7,000 people are waiting for a home in Plymouth, and it's a bleak picture across Devon. As the general election is imminent, Shelter is calling on all political parties to work together to come up with solutions. Strategic lead at Shelter Plymouth, Stuart Francis Dubois, told me what he thinks needs to be done.
First one is the Renters Reform Act, which the government have brought in, would ban no-fault evictions, the so-called Section 21 notice. And whilst that's part of the Act, that's not going to be introduced anytime soon. In fact, you know, possibly never, because they can't get it to work at the moment. And the courts just aren't ready for it to deal with people. So the first thing would be to ban no-fault eviction. So actually people have to have a reason for being evicted and kind of be evicted on a whim of the landlord because he wants to convert it into a bed and breakfast or something else. And the second thing is to build more social housing. We're calling on the government to build 90,000 social homes across the country every year, because that's what we need in order to fix the housing emergency we're currently in. We've done some work in terms of financial modelling, looking at the cost and benefit of building social homes. And to be honest, the payback is between 3 and 5 years, because it's not just in terms of reduced housing benefit bill, for example, but it's also the impact it has on people's mental and physical health, the savings to the NHS, the savings to all the different agencies who are able to, you know, the people have a secure home, they're far more likely to have a successful life. That's why, you know, we say home is everything, and it is. You know, if you've got a stable, secure home, you can build on that. But if you haven't, if you're living in temporary accommodation, or if you're being constantly evicted by landlords, then you can't really build any sort of life from that.
That was Stuart Francis Dubois from Shelter explaining how having a home is the basis for having a successful life. Not surprisingly, with the rise in rent costs, no-fault evictions and lack of emergency housing, the number of rough sleepers in Plymouth is also increasing. In the autumn of 2023, there were 41 people sleeping rough in the city. Here's Stuart again.
I was out on the rough sleeper count. We do a count every November. We count the number of people who are rough sleeping. And we went out in the centre of Plymouth and we counted more people this year than we'd counted in the whole of Plymouth last year, just in the centre of Plymouth. The numbers have gone up considerably. They've not, I don't think, been actually produced from our November count yet, but just the number of people we're seeing. And we're seeing those all over the place. You'll notice, I mean, if you're, you know, out and about, you'll notice there are sort of, you know, tents in the woods and all sorts of things. And that's people who are essentially sleeping rough with nowhere to go. Now, November is pretty much a low point in terms of rough sleeping for the southwest. It will go up in the summer when things get a bit warmer. We like to see a considerable number of people sleeping rough. The real issue there is that there's nowhere for those people to go, just nowhere. We need more supported housing, places they can go where they can get the support they need. I mean, often, you know, when you see people who've been on the streets for some time, it's not unsurprising that they would perhaps be taking drugs or alcohol, because it's cold and wet and horrible out there and pretty dangerous too. We've never seen as bad as it is at the moment. It used to be that if you had to leave your home because of a Section 21 notice, you could just go to the estate agent and you could find yourself somewhere else fairly straightforwardly. You might have to you might have to view a few properties first, but you'd find somewhere. Now, I've spoken to estate agents, they've got 100 people on the list. That's 100 people looking for a home. You've got no chance. You know, if you've got children, if you've got pets, if you have a bad credit history, all those things can count against you. And the landlord will take the person who hasn't got those. They'll take the person with a good credit history who's got, you know, 6 months or a year's rent in advance. And we've seen a lot of landlords where there's a bidding war, a rental bidding war, and we've never seen that. I was talking to some people in temporary accommodation in Plymouth last week, and there was a family of four living in one room in essentially a bed and breakfast. They've got a kettle. That's all they've got to cook with. So I was talking to this young lad, he's 14, and he eats salads because that's all they can do. And he goes out running. It's weird for a 14-year-old. He goes out running at 5 o'clock every morning because he wants to get out of the house and use a bit of energy. Yeah. And, you know, he's in a room with his parents. He's 14. That's not a home, is it? That's just existing. And the chances are they'll be there for a year, 18 months before they get something permanent. In Plymouth, for example, they might be placed in Tavistock, they might be placed in Exeter. So of course, they've got no friends and family around them. Mm. And then they've got to try and get to school, which is, you know, can be miles away. So it's a really tough existence and not something I think many of us would cope very well with. But I suppose it's better than being on the streets, but only marginally.
Stuart Francis Dubois there from Shelter. Now, Plymouth City Council says the number of people in temporary accommodation currently stands at 354. In the last few months, it's committed to purchasing more temporary accommodation, lent money to local charity PATH so that they can do likewise, and it's been successful in obtaining government funding. It's also recently launched its new plan for homes to speed up new developments and improve poor housing conditions. It says 2,200 affordable homes have been delivered for sale and rent since 2014, with another 302 currently under construction. Just to make it clear, affordable homes can include shared ownership and lower than market price homes for sale. Social rented homes, the preference of Shelter, are just a portion of these. Councillor Chris Penberthy, Cabinet Member for Housing, said to me, "There's no dressing this up. The national picture is grim and we have a significant housing crisis on our hands." He said, "Sadly, we're seeing this play out in Plymouth, and quite simply, there's no magic wand to fix it and we're having to be imaginative. We would like there to be an immediate and longer term homelessness strategy and funding solution from the next government." He said, "While we do our best with the funding available to us in Plymouth, the current homelessness prevention grant remains a short-term funding and does not match the increased demand we are responding to."
The issue, as Alison said, is affecting every part of Devon and probably every part of the country. Mid Devon, for instance, the council in my patch, just as an example, it's an issue that's, you know, they're having to tackle as well. So there are some positive movements in relation to it. So the council recently purchased 11 properties using some government funding that will hopefully help reduce the council's reliance on more expensive B&Bs to house its growing homelessness numbers. It was also the first authority in Devon, I think, to agree to give care leavers to stop charging them council tax. So obviously care leavers are obviously they have homes when they're in care, but once they turn 18, they're no longer in care. They're potentially out on their own. And that's a big, big step. So Mid Devon now doesn't levy council tax upon care leavers. Again, a step maybe to mitigate that level of homelessness. In East Devon, you've got sort of things going on as well that every council is also dealing with in terms of Ukrainian households. And early this year, East Devon had almost 150 Ukrainian households, either homeless or at risk of homelessness. And that's besides residents who have lived in the county for longer than those people who've come because of the obviously terrible conflict in their country. So it's a really challenging situation for all councils, and there's really no easy way out.
So do you think housing and homelessness is going to be a really important issue with the election coming up? I was thinking today there are a lot of interviews on the TV and the radio from people saying, well, what are the main issues that are going to make you vote one way or the other? And for some people, it's immigration. For other people, it's the economy. I kind of think in this part of the world, housing is going to be key, don't you?
I think it is. And, you know, if the local elections are anything to go by, it was certainly talked about a lot there. So I think that will be reflected when it comes to the national picture. And it is, it's such a crucial thing, isn't it? You know, what they were saying, Shelter was saying earlier about, you know, it's a basic need and it can affect every aspect of your life. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's something that's getting increasingly worse. Someone's going to have to do something about it, and the government's going to be a big player in that. So yeah, I think it is going to be a big issue for everybody.
Yeah, and I was listening to the full council meeting, the annual council meeting at Mid Devon last night, and leader Luke Taylor from the ruling Liberal Democrat administration there was making a lot of the council's housing delivery strategy, so to speak, and mentioned several affordable homes projects that the council's bringing forward. And it's working with a modular homes specialist to try and provide houses with affordable social rent, in sort of, I guess, brownfield sites, so to speak, like sort of demolishing garages and building some flats on them or houses and that sort of thing. So that's one example of the councils that I cover trying to slowly but surely make sure they're creating more social houses for people, which obviously is a good thing for people because they need houses of their own, but it also alleviates the pressure on the council itself for having to provide emergency accommodation or looking at its long list of residents who don't have anywhere to live. So I think you're right, Guy. I think it will be an issue that will resonate with people in Devon particularly.
And there are so many facets to it as well, aren't there? There's second home ownership in places like South Hams. There's the problem of purpose-built student accommodation springing up in places like Exeter. And I mean, Ali, West Devon has got its own problems as well, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And what they're trying to do at the moment is get landowners to come forward with small pieces of land that they've got, because a lot of the brownfield sites have been built on. So now you're going to have to look at greenfield sites. So some of those fields that will be exception sites for affordable housing only, but they need to come forward at a cost that people can afford to build on. So yeah, that's the appeal at the moment, going out for people to come forward with their pieces of odd little fields and things that they've got. I mean, that could be the answer. And also they want small developments. They don't want massive developments. That's where you get a lot of objection. If you can find smaller or provide smaller developments of like 20 homes, I think that's, people are happier with that, aren't they, than like 170 houses built next to them. So yeah, I think there's lots of ideas in the melting pot at the moment. It just needs a bit of government help too, I think.
Still to come on Devoncast this week: a town czar, that's hard to say as well, and council chaos. But first, water in Brixham. Now, you'll know that water supplies in Brixham have been disrupted over the last week or so by the discovery of a nasty little parasite called Cryptosporidium in the water supply in some parts of the town. Dozens of people have suffered diarrhoea and vomiting, and two have been hospitalised. Thousands of households were told to boil their water as a precaution, and South West Water dished out many thousands of litres of bottled water to tide people over. The latest position today, and we're recording on Thursday the 23rd of May, is that customers in the Hillhead water supply area still need to boil water before use. A probable cause of contamination has been identified and engineers are working hard to fully resolve the issue. South West Water will only lift the remaining boil water notice when it's entirely satisfied it's safe to do so. But not everyone's been happy with the way South West Water has handled this, although the people on the ground in the high-vis jackets making sure people get the water they need, even if it comes in bottles, have done a heck of a job. And when the privatised water company chose this week, of all weeks, to announce an increased dividend for shareholders, that went down like a cup of Cryptosporidium. And there's a bank holiday coming, and beautiful Brixham is open for business. I spoke to Totnes MP Anthony Magnall, whose constituency also covers Brixham. It was interesting timing for South West Water to choose the time of the Brixham incident to announce an increased dividend for shareholders. Anthony Magnall wasn't very happy about it and had some words for CEO Susan Davey.
Listen, I can understand. I can absolutely understand why water companies might issue dividends. I can absolutely understand why privatised water companies, which I think is the right model rather than the nationalised model, which would see taxpayers having to pay for outdated water networks and infrastructure. I can see why dividends are issued, but it's also a handling point. You don't issue dividends at a point when you're in the middle of a confidence crisis, when you've got a crisis in the town in which people have fallen quite seriously ill. That, to me, is a tin-eared approach, and I think it's totally, totally unacceptable to be going through this problem, this issue, this matter in Brixham, and see Pennon paying out dividends. I've offered two options. The responsibility always lies with the head. And so therefore I make this point, either suspend the dividend payments or step down. And that is, I think, to be honest, as clear as I can be about the fact that we need to have confidence in South West Water. Residents need to feel that it is not just for shareholders, but for the consumer who are going to get a good, reliable service, including, whether it's storm overflow networks or drinking water.
Some local businesses have been badly hit by this. Some say they've lost thousands of pounds worth of bookings. They need to be compensated.
I think Alex Foley put it perfectly for the Guardhouse Cafe yesterday and in other interviews. Businesses, of course, need compensation. And as far as I can see, South West Water has said that they will offer compensation on a case-by-case basis to businesses. I'm organising a meeting this week for the Chamber of Commerce of Brixham to meet with South West Water representatives and to take it from there and for them to have a conversation about how that is going to play out and how businesses can be able to make their case. The business hotline is up and running for businesses in Brixham to contact South West Water and to make their claims and to have that conversation with them, and obviously we'll make sure they are delivering. I mean, this has impacted residents in a significant way and it's impacted businesses, and there must be compensation for them.
Local people too need answers and reassurance, and the MP has been talking on a regular basis with South West Water.
You heard yesterday that from the Secretary of State, when this was raised in my urgent question in Parliament, that the first phase of UKHSA's inquiry investigation has already been drawn to a conclusion. So the next phases are underway. We shouldn't be waiting for many months. We need a quick and speedy investigation into what has gone on, what has happened. And even if it is third party, the lessons for South West Water are going to be severe, because they're handling their communications with the public. Some of the misinformation that's come out as well has been, I think, a source of frustration and annoyance to residents. I've been on daily calls with South West Water. I'm in communications with them on an almost hourly basis to receive updates and a better understanding of where things lie.
I also asked him if South West Water was doing enough for the people of Brixham and South Devon as they prepared for a big bank holiday weekend ahead.
They're not doing enough because we shouldn't be in this position in the first place. You know, it is not beyond the wit of man to think that we should have a system that is resilient and inspected and routinely modernised to make sure that people have got safe drinking water. But Brixham is bouncing back. That's the message that we should all be pushing, because what's been remarkable to see is the community spirit come alive. It's been remarkable to see how quickly businesses have adapted. And ahead of the bank holiday weekend, Brixham is open for business. And that, to me, is the most important thing at the moment, because the water system is being flushed, it's been cleaned, the Alston Reservoir is back online. It's been independently monitored and verified and continues to do to be so. And the Hillhead Reservoir will undoubtedly come back online in the coming days. So it's absolutely essential we recognise there have been some systematic, horrendous problems, but also that the community and town of Brixham is open for business, especially ahead of this main bank holiday.
That was Totnes MP Anthony Magnall speaking about South West Water's response to the Cryptosporidium outbreak in Brixham. The company says the health and safety of its customers remains its absolute priority.
The Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, was actually in Exeter at the back end of last week, and that was amid all the trouble going on with Brixham. She was actually visiting the University of Exeter as part of nationwide plans to provide more medical school places, but inevitably the topic of Brixham's water kind of dominated the interview process from all the journalists there. When Victoria Atkins was asked about the situation with the water company and the parasite outbreak in the town, she said that she thought South West Water would have some very, very hard questions to answer, in her words. But she did say she thought the company should be given time and space to conduct their investigation. At the time, she said they'd identified the source and the public would still, though, want to know what happened and the chain of events that led to it. And that basically there's obviously an understanding among all of us that we're very lucky when we turn our taps on, we have clean, clear, safe water to drink. So, it was interesting that was all going on amid the Health Secretary's visit to Exeter, even though she was there for a very different reason. You're listening to Devoncast, which is available on the Radio X website and app, from your regular podcast provider, and on Devoncast Radio, which is on DAB digital radio across most of the county.
I had a huddle with a Hawksby the other day, one of those media events where all sorts of reporters pile on and get to ask a question in turn. The government's town's Tsar is a man called Adam Hawksby, and he's been on a tour of the country visiting towns which have had a little bit left behind when it comes to investment. There are 55 towns around the country getting a slice of a £1.5 billion fund to help level them up. And Torquay is getting £20 million, which will be allocated to local projects by a specially set up town board. Critics say this is just the government getting ready for an election by giving towns back a little of the money it's kept back from them over the last 10 years or so. But Mr. Hawksby and the town board argue that it can still make a real difference in a place like Torquay. Here he is, explaining why tackling antisocial behaviour is likely to be top of the list in Torquay.
So Torbay was a really interesting visit, and actually the antisocial behaviour challenge there was, to be honest, a pretty significant one. It was one of the more challenging ones I've seen. There are two types of antisocial behaviour in most of the areas that I've been to. Some of it is mainly around young people, so that will be lots of kind of school-aged children that are often congregating in public places, can be quite intimidating to members of the public, often aren't engaging us in Grand Theft Auto, but they are, you know, engaging in behaviour that makes people not feel safe, walking around on the street, shopping, etc., etc. The other type, actually the type I saw more in Torbay, was some of the challenges around individuals that are homeless, might be addicted to drugs, might be recently out of prison, and particularly the challenge around the kind of halfway home in the council, that kind of top area of the high street. So clearly something needs to be done there. Two types of approaches that I think work and that the long-term plan for towns can financially support are one, kind of deterrence. So that might be hotspots policing, CCTV, improvements of bits of the public realm where people are congregating. And that might be in coordination with the police. It's why we've got police and crime commissioners on the town's boards. But the other really important thing you can do is prevention, right? So for the young people, that might be prevention through the provision of youth activities, culture, sport, things like that, ensuring they have something productive to do with their time. And in terms of the challenge that I saw in Torquay specifically, you're going to need to have some programs to support those individuals that are really vulnerable, have found themselves in a difficult spot, and at the moment are kind of susceptible to drug dealers that are around or other sorts of crimes. And that might be wraparound support for those individuals, helping them find housing, helping them to get off of substances. So those are the sorts of things that I imagine the town board in Torquay are going to focus on.
That was Adam Hawksby, the government's town's Tsar, talking about some exciting new investment in Torquay. And one more bit of unfinished business to conclude. We talked last week about the chaos at Torbay Council after the ceremonial mayor-making meeting went bad, and now the authority has been left in a state of paralysis in the aftermath of a stormy meeting which resulted in a walkout by opposition councillors. Liberal Democrats, Independents and the lone representative of Prosper Torbay got up and left the chamber in protest as the meeting at the Riviera Centre ended in chaos. Now a string of meetings has been called off because the makeup of the council's committees will not be decided until after a crucial by-election in Torbay next month. The position of mayor, which is normally ceremonial, is more delicate this year because the council split 18-17 in favour of the non-Tory opposition. The mayor has a casting vote in the event of a tied council decision, making the position crucial in the coming 12 months. The by-election takes place on 6th of June in Wellswood, which is traditional Tory territory. And it all kicked off after that. Council leader David Thomas moved a successful motion to adjourn selecting committee memberships and chairs until June the 20th, saying it would make sense to deal with it after the by-election. The motion would go straight to the vote with no debate, he said, in line with the council's own standing orders. That sparked the opposition's angry walkout during the course of the meeting. Now, a number of key meetings scheduled for the next month have had to be called off because the committees have no chairs or members. A meeting focusing on adult social care has been axed, along with one on caring for children and young people. The council's audit committee will skip its scheduled meeting, as will the overview and scrutiny board and committees overseeing Oldway Mansion and Torbay's harbours. So my diary of Torbay meetings, which is usually pretty hectic, has been emptied in one fell swoop. Council business is getting done, of course, because officers and staff are working hard as they always do. But the forward-facing public bit, the actual meetings, will pretty much stop for the next month. I might as well go and play pitch and putt in the sunshine.
That's Devoncast, your weekly podcast rounding up all of the county's crucial stories. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening and whatever you're doing while you listen. We've heard from quite a few listeners this week with opinions on Devoncast, which is great. You can reach us by email at news@radiox.co.uk if you'd like to tell us how wonderful we are, how terrible we are, or anything in between. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember, you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back soon.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.